It's Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Welcome.
Something like garlic mustard, they have garlic mustard poles. They can pull up thousands, tens of thousands of plants. But one plant can produce 10,000 seeds to replace every single one of those plants.
That's biologist Keith Clay. What's the best way to control invasive plants? We'll visit a couple nature preserves to find out what it takes to get an ecosystem back to its preferred wild state. A story from Harvest Public Media today about hydroponics, soil, and the true meaning of organic food. We'll also hear from Adam Quirk of Cardinal Spirits. It was a love of literature that led him to learn about distilling. And Chef Daniel gives his guests their own shakers filled with cranberries, apple cider, and two types of booze. Taking a look at news with Mark.
Shareholders at Monsanto agreed to a merger this week with the German drug and chemical maker Bayer, moving the controversial deal one step closer to fruition. Bayer plans to pay shareholders $66 billion to take over Monsanto. That breaks down to $128 per share if the merger closes. Already dominated by just a few large firms, the industry that sells seeds and chemicals to the world's farmers could further consolidate in the coming months, as five of the six largest companies are pursuing deals that could leave a market dominated by just three behemoth global companies. The companies, however, will likely drop their bids to consolidate if antitrust regulators in many of the world's largest markets, including the U.S., do not approve the moves. The merger of the two companies is projected to close by the end of 2017 and is awaiting antitrust approval. And researchers say better diets and changes in the food industry have spurred cholesterol levels in the U.S. to drop over the last decade and a half. The study, published in the journal JAMA Cardiology, looked at national survey data to compare total cholesterol levels in 39,000 adults over an 8-year span. The researchers found that total cholesterol levels lowered by 7% between 1999 and 2014. The study's author said the removal of trans fatty acids from foods could help explain improved cholesterol levels. Last year, the FDA officially banned trans fats as an additive, but many companies had been phasing those ingredients out of products voluntarily. You can read more at eartheats.org.
Thanks to Mark Chilla.
You bet.
To be labeled as organic, fruits and vegetables are required to be grown without genetic modification or synthetic chemicals. But what about produce that isn't grown in the dirt? There's a battle going on in the organic industry over hydroponics, the technique of growing plants without soil. As Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted reports, it gets at the very heart of what it means to be organic.
Chris Beckman raises organic beef and is the manager of Lincoln University's organic farm in central Missouri. That's where he's driving today, checking in on the plants and animals. And while we're there, we stop by a new addition to the farm, built recently by a colleague.
And we can take a look at it if you want to.
Yeah, let's take a look.
We hop out of the car and walk to what looks like a large bus stop covered in clear plastic tarps held down by blocks. Beckman peels the shelter open.
So she currently has developed this as a recirculating hydroponic system in which she has the 6-inch PVC pipe drilled holes, and she was growing a lettuce crop in here.
The rows of pipe run parallel to the ground and connect to a pump, which circulates a nutrient-rich fluid called compost tea. In this hydroponic system, that compost tea contains all of the nutrients the lettuce needs to grow. No soil needed.
Technically, this could be organic.
Technically, yes, because since she's doing a compost tea that does not utilize any type of man-made fertilizers or ingredients, all the ingredients here that are going to the compost tea are eligible for organic production.
And that's a problem for many farmers who say soil is the essential ingredient for organic production. Many organic farmers say that from its very inception, organic farming was built on nurturing soil health.
So yes, it does come down to what is the definition of organic production and is it truly eligible?
Ultimately, how the organic label is defined will shape the identity of what consumers expect from their organic kale. Farmers on both sides have been weighing in, and it's up to the National Organic Standards Board to advise the U.S. Department of Agriculture on what rule to make.
I understand that there's, you know, definitely a whole spectrum of how people interpret organic.
That's Oklahoma organic farmer Emily Oakley, who also sits on the board.
It's this, you know, beauty of looking at working with the natural ecosystem, and soil is the foundation of that.
Many small organic farmers are worried that cheaper year-round produce harvested from hydroponic farms and warehouses will undercut organic prices. On the other side are hydroponic farmers who contend their system protects soil by not even using it. At its November meeting, the National Organic Standards Board decided that while it is largely against adding hydroponics to the organic label, members needed more time to refine their official recommendation to the USDA.
It's a difficult issue to take a stand on, and I think they're looking for the most clear language possible to allow them to take a stand.
At its core, this argument is one of many popping up as the $43 billion organic industry explodes in popularity. Other organic dilemmas include, what is an organic fish? How big can an organic farm get? Should organic farmers be forced to pay into an industry group for lobbying and research?
You know, you may not get 100% of everything you're looking for in the solution, but the stakeholders, everybody feels heard. Everybody feels like the information was on the table. There was good deliberation.
Laura Batcha, CEO of the Organic Trade Association, says the issues might be new, but debate over what is and isn't organic has always been a part of the industry. It is constantly wrestling with new technology and techniques.
And it really is a farming and production system intended to meet the consumer's needs and expectations.
Indeed, a recent Pew Research survey showed 4 out of 10 Americans eat at least some organic food. Ultimately, it's consumers who hold the power, and they vote with their wallets at the grocery store. So if customers start snapping up hydroponically produced organic cucumbers, we'll likely see the organic sector shift again. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
More stories like this one at harvestpublicmedia.org. You know, in restaurants, how they frame that first dollar bill they ever received, sort of like a museum piece? Well, at Cardinal Spirits, the relics are on a high shelf behind the bar in the tasting room. It's a half dozen ball jars filled with vodka and various add-ins.
Two of them are from 2010, when I first moved here.
They're a reminder of where Adam Quirk started.
I used to do all this stuff in my basement, and then when I had a distillery, now I can get all that stuff up onto some real shelves. So there's two blueberry infusions, a couple different vodkas with lemon, one with pepin peppers and one with serrano.
Adam is the CEO of Cardinal Spirits. He distills vodka, his favorite spirit, and 9 other liquors at this facility in Bloomington, Indiana. We're in the tasting room right now.
Well, that blueberry is really good, actually. I'll get that down. It tastes like grandma's blueberry pie. It's got a little lemon peel in it, too.
Yeah, he has to climb up on the counter and balance on his tiptoes to grab the jar. Back in the day, these vodka infusions lived on a bookshelf in his bedroom. And his preference for posh-tasting liquors also originated on that bookshelf.
So in college, I went to Ball State. I was living with my friend Nick, and at the time, we were both really into both Hunter S. Thompson and Hemingway. We couldn't get enough. We read all their books. And I read this Hemingway book, the one where he's hunting lions in Africa. He talks about basically setting up this camp, and he opens up this wooden case of Campari. And if you know Campari, it's like this very sweet and bitter citrus liqueur from Italy. It's like, well, first of all, why are you drinking that in, like, sunny Africa? But I was like, all right, that sounds, you know, super romantic. I'm going to go try to find this. I finally made my way to a fancy liquor store, and it's the first time I've ever been in one. Bought a bottle. It was, like, $35, which was a lot for me. But I bought it. I brought it home. And, you know, we both poured a glass, like, a fairly big glass of Campari. And and took a sip. At that time, I had not tasted anything worse in my life. It was, you know, super bitter and cloying, but I was a huge Hemingway fan, so I was like, all right, we're going to do this, guys. Kept drinking. It probably took us, you know, 2 hours to finish this one drink. But by the end of it, I was like, you know, these last couple sips were okay. It's like, it does have these interesting citrus notes, and it's got this flavor that I've never tasted before. And so I was actually kind of hooked. And that started a path for me of exploring all sorts of spirits that I'd never heard of or tried before.
He left college during his junior year to try his luck in New York City. He worked in kitchens and behind bars, making just enough money to pay the bills.
So I couldn't afford like fancy spirits, but I did know how to make infusions. So I would buy, you know, a cheap bottle of Kharkov vodka, run it through a Brita pitcher, which actually makes it taste a little more palatable.
Is that true?
It is, yeah. It's carbon filtering, and so I did that, and then I would throw it in ball jars with various fruits and spices and herbs, and doing that, you can make something actually really delicious. And, you know, as a single guy in New York, you're trying to impress, you know, whoever, and going on a picnic and pulling out a jar of, you know, homemade vodka infused with strawberry and nectarine is like a pretty pretty solid move. I did that in Prospect Park. A girl I dated for maybe 6 months or a year invited me out on a picnic fairly early in that relationship to meet with her friends. And, you know, we set up a few blankets over by, I think it was called the Duck Pond. You know, everyone else brought some food. I pulled out these jars that I had actually kept in the freezer, and it was like May or so it was actually warm out. These nice cold jars of like one of them was that strawberry nectarine. So I passed around those shots of, you know, ice cold infused vodka, and it felt very, you know, Gatsby-ish. But I'm not a huge fan of him actually. But since it was New York and since it was like late spring and it was a picnic in the park, it just felt like Fitzgerald.
He thought about selling his infusions, or what about learning how to make liquor himself? He connected with distillers in New York to learn the ropes on their equipment. He took courses in artisan distilling. In 2010, it was back to Indiana, where he hatched plans to open one of the state's first craft distilleries. Cardinal Spirits opened on February 9th, 2015. I imagine that first day was the last time that Adam hoisted himself onto the counter to interact with these ball jars. They've been infusing for 6 years at this point, and they're all cloudy from the bits of fruit.
Before I had real filters.
Cheers.
Cheers.
He still makes infusions at home for fun. That probably will never change. What has changed is his free time that he's able to devote to reading.
Last year, I actually didn't read, but I kind of told myself this January that I had to like make some time.
On his bookshelf now, Still Life with Woodpecker by Tom Robbins. She's around to rock and tell you that. Adam Quirk is the CEO of Cardinal Spirits. We have photos of him popping open that blueberry infusion at eartheats.org. Drinks has been the theme of our December shows. Coming up, a cocktail recipe for holiday entertaining. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From vegetarian to paleo and low carb. Taste matters. Your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com. and Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net.
All right, we're going to shake things up today on Earth Eats.
That's Chef Daniel Orr.
We're going to make one of our shake-up drinks, which we do in ball jars here at Farm Bloomington. They're great for a party because you can measure everything out ahead in ball jars, and then you just add the ice and shake them up and serve them to your guests. So you can pre-portion everything. It's a real simple way to entertain. I've got some fresh cranberries that I've chopped in the food processor. Then I've got the one piece of orange peel, orange zest, that you can take off with a vegetable peeler. Drop that in there. Then I've got some fresh basil out of my garden. Crunch that up a little bit, bring out those essential oils. So to this we're going to add some of our local applejack because it's going to be kind of a cranberry apple martini. Then we've got some really nice Creole shrub rum. So that's a orange rum, but you could use Grand Marnier or Triple Sec. And I'm going to actually put a little slice of lime inside. And then I'm going to top it off with apple cider. And then when your guests get here, fill it up with ice until it's about 3/4 of the way full. Then you put the lid on. You give it a good shake.
Like your own personal shaker.
Yeah. And then we're going to just put a little fizz on it with some club soda. Give it a stir. And you've got a wonderful shake-up. Cheers, everybody. Enjoy.
As the saying goes, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. That's especially true when we're talking about invasives, plants that don't belong in an ecosystem and can quickly grow and crowd out native varieties. Prevention sometimes involves hand-pulling these nasty plants, and sometimes it involves spraying herbicide. I visited the Sycamore Land Trust to find out how they deal with invasives. John Lawrence is suited up with a jetpack of triclopyr, an herbicide specific to broad-leaved plants. In his hand is a sprayer wand that allows him to direct the blue liquid to the exact spot he wants to kill. He says this is probably his favorite part of the job.
I really do feel that there's a meditative quality to coming out here and doing this. Okay, concentrating on what's in front of you and listening to the sounds of the birds and crickets around us while we're doing a little spritz and a spritz.
Lawrence is the assistant director of Sycamore Land Trust, a nonprofit organization that conserves land by acquisition or by holding conservation easements. He and I are just steps away from the Sycamore headquarters. Today's project is to try to beat back one particular invasive from moving from their front lawn into the adjacent woods.
Right here, as we're standing, we've got a whole bunch. This is kind of a carpet of this real thick, kind of shiny-leaved plant. A lot of people know that as periwinkle or vinca.
It's everywhere. Cover. Are we really going to get all of this?
Well, we'll get what we can. This has been a little bit of a project now and again to try and beat this back a little bit.
Tell me why we don't like it. I mean, why is this worse than the other stuff here?
Right. Well, because it is forming a carpet, and in doing so is excluding all the nice native plants that belong here and that interact with all the insects and birds and other wildlife to create a healthy food web and healthy ecosystem. And with a lot of these bushes, like Asian bush honeysuckle, it greens up earlier and stays green later than some of the natives, so it's shading things out. Some actually excrete chemicals that harm the plants nearby, so they're using chemical warfare.
And which is you're using chemical warfare.
And so sometimes we have to use chemical warfare too.
He points a little further into the woods where native plants are popping up through the vinca, like a baby redbud tree, some bottlebrush grass, and white snake root. But here, the vinca is just too dense for anything else to grow. It's also too dense to pull it by hand. It'll probably take 2 or 3 more applications over the next year to eradicate the vinca entirely.
I'm teaching a course now, and one we had a unit on invasive plants, so just looking at this list...
Keith Clay is a distinguished professor of biology at Indiana University. He says the list of invasives around Indiana is just growing.
Japanese knotweed is a big issue in many areas. Canadian thistle.
New invasive plants in the Midwest. New?
Yeah, they're constantly coming in. Giant hogweed, if you touch it, you get a nasty rash like poison ivy that lasts for weeks. Oh, Bradford pear is another bad invasive. We've planted it all over the city streets in Bloomington, thinking it was a good street tree, and now it's popping up everywhere, and it's a real pest. So the cat is out of the bag already. Even though they won't plant anymore, it's not going to go away because it's been given such a boost by planting so many trees around. The seeds are everywhere.
He points to the garden and landscaping trade as the way many invasive plants were introduced. He says the plants were undoubtedly favored because they were vigorous and adapted to a wide range of conditions.
In the case of the Asian bush honeysuckle and many other invasive shrubs, they produce a lot of berries that birds eat, and then the birds spread them all over the place. And we see many invasive species for sale in nurseries. Sometimes they're unaware, or other times, you know, it's the profit motive overrides any environmental concerns.
Some of those plants have culinary uses, too. We've talked about wild garlic mustard greens on Earth Eats before. There's also perilla, a member of the mint family.
And it was a garden plant. I think it was used as an herb for the minty taste. It's also kind of a pretty flower. It comes in different leaf colors, green, purple, variegated. It's, I would say, an incipient invasive species all around Monroe County in certain areas. It just is incredibly dense. And it's an annual, produces a lot of seed, so it can spread quickly and widely.
As he explains it, when a non-native plant is introduced, either by human action or on their own, those plants leave their insect pests and pathogens behind. The pests may eventually catch up, but in the meantime, humans must intervene. You can pull some of these plants by hand.
And something like garlic mustard, they have garlic mustard pulls. They can pull up thousands, tens of thousands of plants. But that's probably replaced. One plant can produce 10,000 seeds to replace every single one of those plants. So the capacity of these plants to reproduce and generate bigger populations is pretty impressive.
Spritzing the plants with herbicide before they have a chance to set seed gives us a fighting chance. Clay says we'll always have invasive species in our ecosystems. And for his purposes, that can actually be beneficial.
This is highly self-motivated, but if we got rid of all invasives, we'd also get rid of a lot of interesting opportunities for research. For example, the idea that pests and pathogens will eventually begin to colonize and attack the invasive species. This is something we're working on right now with Japanese stilt grass. These fungal pathogens seem to have made a jump onto the stilt grass, and we have hopes that maybe it'll help bring it under control. So we're watching that process going on right now. Where are these fungi coming from? Did they get here from the native range, or are they jumping from native species or other invasive species? We don't know, but they're coming from somewhere, and it's an interesting question, I think.
Did he say which side? This side?
John Lawrence organized a volunteer work day at one of Sycamore's newest areas, the Sam Shine Foundation Preserve.
I see red berries. Does that mean that's what that is?
That's the one.
The target today is Asian bush honeysuckle. Volunteers are armed with hedge clippers and spray bottles of herbicides. First, they cut down the bush as close to the ground as possible. Then they spritz on the cut stem.
The red berries, the light-colored stump.
Got it.
Pretty much the giveaway.
There we go. Just giving a good squirt right at where you cut.
Right, while it's still moist. It's important not to let it dry up.
With the idea that it's going to go down to the roots?
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully the plant won't come back.
So now that I know what to look for, they're everywhere.
They're everywhere.
Lawrence is suited up with a different kind of jetpack today. He's operating a gas-powered saw. He's eyeing a 12-foot-high Asian bush honeysuckle with a multi-stemmed trunk.
That is a big, big bush, and it's taken up a lot of space and sunlight and water. And as you can see, this thing is just absolutely loaded with red berries. Every one of those berries is a potential new invading bush that can be flown for miles before it is deposited. Fire this sucker up.
The eventual goal is to get this area back to what it wants to be, whether that be a swamp or a forest. Lawrence has been doing this sort of work with sycamore for years, and while it feels like fighting a losing battle at times, there are spots that are showing progress.
There's some spots that I've been working on for some years, and they finally turned the corner, and it's super rewarding to go back where, wow, you know, 5-6 years ago, I was out here with volunteers and we pulled bags and bags of garlic mustard. Now there's just a handful, and instead there are all these beautiful spring wildflowers there instead, you know, trillium and cutleaf toothwort, all those pretty things.
This is what land stewardship looks like, he says. They're doing this work with an eye toward the future.
And there's also, I think, kind of a living museum quality, I think, to preserving some natural areas in close to a pristine state as possible, where people can go and see this is what Indiana used to look like. But in this human-altered matrix, there's always going to be a little bit of maintenance work. It's kind of like fixing the roof on your house a little bit. It's might get a little water leak here or there. You're going to have to patch it. It's always going to keep raining outside.
And there will always be invasives, but both Lawrence and Clay agree that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Read more at sycamorelandtrust.org. A native plant that makes a delicious tea? Spice bush. There's a very cool article with the history of spice bush tea and a recipe at eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including website guru Aobon Binder, reporters Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Christopher Husted, Taylor Killo, and everyone at Harvest Public Media, and of course, Chef Daniel Orr. Our executive producer is John Bailey. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses. Located on the Beeline Trail, more information at personalfinancialservices.net. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets, from gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. I'm Annie Corrigan. Thanks for listening.